city. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for this morning is the Tool Works versus Commissioner of Internal Revenue.
Good morning.
Mr. Durham.
May it please the court, I'm Thomas C. Durham, representing the appellant Illinois Tool Works. The issue to be decided by this court is whether the $7 million in question is the cost of an asset or the cost of a business decision that went bad. This is an issue which needs to be decided on its own special facts. According to the recent decisions of this court and other courts, the issue requires a pragmatic, real-life assessment of whether this $7 million is more properly viewed as a cost of acquisition or as the cost of a business judgment. This is an inquiry to be performed without the application of what this court has termed talismanic rules. An expense which might be capital in the course of one business may well be deductible in another business. The facts of this case are not in dispute. There has never been a case with comparable facts, and there may never be another one.
Well, the cost of the lawsuit, the cost of the claim that was pending at the time was clearly part of the capital of assets that were being purchased as liabilities in this case, correct?
The cost of the assumption of the lawsuit,
yeah,
was a condition of acquiring the asset.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a part of the calculations that went into how much money was going to be paid.
Yes, and the part
how much liability was on the hook here.
And the parties calculated that liability was roughly $300,000, $400,000. Everyone.
By the way, the lawyer who gave the opinion that that patent infringement case was meritless didn't exactly have an accurate prediction of it.
Well, Mr. Littleton himself, the holder of the patent, his highest offer that he ever made was $1 million. He made a variety of offers that ranged from $500,000, which would have fit right in with the party's assessment of that claim, up to $1 million. He never asked for more than $1 million. So his Mr. Lummelson's assessment of the claim, the holder of the claim, was much closer to what the parties had intended than the jury verdict was. And of course, ITW, which is the main point of our appeal, ITW had within its means the ability to control its liability because it could have settled the lawsuit on a number of occasions from somewhere between $800,000 to $1 million. A federal judge had earlier claimed that the Lummelson lawsuit was worthless, and as a result of the judge's claim in that earlier case, Mr. Lummelson had settled that case for $5,000. That was exactly the same a patent that is involved in this lawsuit. The lawsuit played no role in the negotiation of the purchase price of the DeVilbiss assets. But most importantly, as I stated,
How could that be, really, as a practical matter? If you're buying something and there's a patent infringement case pending, that the value of that would not have been an important consideration in the price you're going to pay.
Both of the parties looked at this, determined that the lawsuit was virtually worthless, only nuisance value, the cost of attorney's fees. And so I think that in the big scheme of things, what was, I believe, a $126 million acquisition, no one really paid any attention to the value of this suit. And I believe that the tax court found that as a finding of fact, that the value of this lawsuit did not play any role in determining where the parties ultimately came out on the purchase price. Mr. Lummelson rejected Mr. Lummelson's repeated offers to settle this case. At each of these points when a settlement was offered, ITW exercised its own business judgment in rejecting Mr. Lummelson's offer. ITW has extensive experience in managing its own patent portfolio. It regularly analyzes, defends, and prosecutes patent infringement actions. And in rejecting Mr. Lemelson's offers, it acted to manage and preserve its current assets, not to acquire additional assets. ITW's decision to take its chances in a trial with Mr. Lemelson, based on its own assessment of the case, was its decision and its decision alone. And its resulting liability is not a necessary, unavoidable cost of the acquisition, but rather is the cost of ITW's independent decision. This court has repeatedly stated that the purpose of the capitalization provisions is to match expenses with revenue. And in cases such as Staley and U.S. Freightways, this court has inquired whether an expenditure creates a future benefit and whether it produces future revenue. So in this case, it's logical to ask, applying the pragmatic test that this court has applied, it's logical to ask whether ITW received any long-term benefit from this expenditure. And it should be obvious that ITW did not receive any benefit. It did not receive any additional assets. It did not receive any additional revenue. This additional expenditure was simply the cost of a business decision which went bad. The government doesn't really address the point of matching expenses with revenue, other than to state that the $16 million was the cost of acquiring these assets. But I believe that response is entirely circular. It assumes the answer to the question. It assumes that this should be treated, that these expenditure should be treated as a cost of an acquisition, when I believe that that is the issue which this court must decide. We must look whether the expense is more properly viewed as the cost of acquisition or as the cost of a business decision that went bad.
I guess what would have been the circumstance if the verdict or the judgment in that case had been $3 million?
I think that is a much closer case, because in this case there is a gross disproportionality between the party's expectations and even Mr. Lemelson's expectations and the eventual jury verdict. Mr. Lemelson's highest offer was $1 million. The jury's verdict totaled $17 million. And I think that that's a fact which ought to be taken into account. It would also be important to take into account ITW's actions, whether they had rejected offers. I think $3 million, while still wildly variant from the party's expectation and Mr. Lemelson's expectation, is closer. The Supreme Court has stated that each of these cases is a question of degree, not of kind. And so when you posit the case with a $3 million payment, that's obviously, in degree, is quite removed from the facts that we have here. And I think that those types of differences in degree, as the Supreme Court has indicated, are sufficient to require different results.
If it is a question of degree, then wouldn't the standard of review more appropriately be something less than de novo here?
Well, this court has stated that the standard of review is de novo. And in U.S. Freightways and Staley, this court reversed the tax court on what I believe were essentially undisputed facts. The facts in U.S. Freightways were stipulated, so clearly there was no dispute in the facts. This court reversed the tax court not for errors in the finding of facts, but for errors of judgment. What I believe the court did in both U.S. Freightways and Staley was to apply sort of rigid talismanic rules, as this court has stated, and that's an error of law. The court did not make the pragmatic assessment that this court's cases and other cases require. And so I think that the issue here is still one of de novo review. In this case, the court applied a strict, what I would call a talismanic rule, with no exceptions. And I think that that was an error of law. As I say, the government's argument on the question of matching expenses and income, well, the government really doesn't address the point other than to say that the $16 million is the cost of acquiring the asset. but that doesn't address the question of whether it's more proper to view this expense in a pragmatic assessment, whether it's more proper to view it as a cost of acquisition or as the cost of the business decision. The government has followed the rule to an illogical conclusion, which is why this court has refused to apply talismanic rules. Common sense tells us the ITW did not gain any long-term benefit from rejecting Mr. Lemelson's offers and from its resulting expenditure of $7 million. Accordingly, the tax court's decision should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Durham. Mr. Collins?
May it please the court, I'm Mike Hongs from the Department of Justice here on behalf of the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. The issue in this case is the tax treatment of money that ITW paid to satisfy a judgment that it had assumed as the cost of acquiring another corporation's assets. And under well-settled principles of tax law, including in particular this court's decision in the case of Webb versus Commissioner from 1983, the payment of that judgment was a cost of the acquisition, and therefore it must be capitalized. ITW is entitled to add it to its basis in the acquired assets, but it's not entitled to an immediate deduction as an ordinary necessary business expense. All of this flows from the basic definition in the tax code of what the basis in property is. Section 1012 of the code says the basis is the cost of property. Cost can be measured by cash that has been paid, and in this case, ITW paid about $125 million for the assets of DeVilbiss, but it can also be measured by assuming a liability of the seller. If I were to buy a house and I paid the buyer $200,000 in cash, but I assumed their mortgage of $300,000, I'd still paid if I assumed a mortgage of $100,000, I would have still paid $300,000 for the house simply by assuming their debt. The only thing that's a little different here is that we're talking not about a fixed debt like a mortgage, but a contingent liability, and that's where this court's decision in Webb comes in. Webb was the case involving the pension payments that had to be made. It was not clear how long the widow of the former employee was going to live. It was not clear how big that liability would ultimately be, but this court correctly held in Webb that the purchaser of those assets had to add the amount of that pension benefit to its basis gradually as the years went by, as more and more pension benefits got paid. And we think
here
that's the case.
Here we have one where, by all accounts, it was a monumental misunderstanding about what the liability might be in this case.
That's true, and I don't think that really affects the ultimate result. And perhaps the ultimate case on that is the Pacific Transport case that comes out of the Ninth Circuit. Pacific Transport involved, like this case did, the assumption of someone else's liability, the assumption of a lawsuit. Pacific Transport, if anything, was even more of a monumental misunderstanding, because what had happened in Pacific Transport is that there had been a favorable decision in the district court on the liability issue in the tort suit. It went to the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit affirmed the district court result, and it was a result that limited the liability greatly. The parties then did the corporate sale, and after the sale had been concluded, the Ninth Circuit granted rehearing en banc and reversed itself. So I'd say that's an even more surprising result to see a court of appeals reverse itself en banc than to have a jury award.
Ninth Circuit.
No comment. But I think those two cases, Webb and Pacific Transport, really are on all fours with this one, and they demonstrate why this liability is really to be treated as a cost of acquisition here. The cases on which ITW has been primarily relying, the A.E. Staley case, the Wells Fargo case, involved a little different issue. And the court was conducting a very careful factual analysis because what was at issue in those cases was incidental costs, transactional costs associated with acquisition of a capital asset. Here what we're talking about is a cost that is part of the consideration for the capital asset. So it's clear that it's associated with the capital asset. It's not merely an ancillary cost of attorney's fees or investment banker fees or something of that nature. And I guess finally I should address counsel's point about the need to match expenses with revenue. We didn't discuss it in any detail in the brief because it doesn't really seem to add much to the analysis here. Their argument on that point is really the same as their arguments elsewhere, which is simply that they want to split up the $17 million payment into different pieces. And in terms of matching expenses with revenue, well, the idea there is that what they received for this $17 million payment was the Develbus assets. It turns out to have been a bigger price than they thought they were going to pay, but that's what they got for it. They got the Develbus assets, and that's where the matchup occurs.
Why do you think this case deserves a deferential review?
Well, to the extent that they are arguing factual questions, as I read their opening brief, it seems like every few pages they made reference to the need for a pragmatic consideration of the specific facts, a particularized inquiry about their situation, then it would seem that they're arguing really a factual case.
No, it doesn't sound that way. It sounds like they accepted facts, and they're talking about how you apply the law to the facts, which is simply a different way of looking at it.
I think the ultimate
question... They're not looking for new facts. They're willing to accept the facts that you've already outlined. They just say the law requires a different approach.
In that case, I would refer to this court's opinions in cases like Heffley and Roper and Rogers v. Western Southern, which we cite in our brief, which say that when you have a mixed question of law and fact and you're applying particular facts to legal standards,
there's no question of fact here. You can't have a mixed question. You agree that the facts are, and they agree the same facts, an agreed set of facts. What fact do you think they're arguing? What fact do you think that they think is there that you don't think is there? Or vice versa?
Well, I think it is correct that they are really arguing the meaning of the facts, the interpretation of the facts.
The application of the law to the facts.
Yes.
So why wouldn't that be de novo review?
Well, I think that applying the law to the facts still involves...
The hell it does. Well, I know what you're going to say. Find a lot of the facts doesn't mean we're making a finding of fact at all. The fact is there, we accept, then we apply the law. If we differ as to what we think the law is or where it's applied, then that's the de novo review. So we're not looking at the facts. As we really accept the facts that you two have agreed to. Those are the facts.
And you think you win under de novo review?
Yes, we believe that we should win either way. And really, the tax court did not spend a lot of time stating what it was finding as a fact, because in this case, it seems pretty simple compared to stating...
Because everybody agreed with the facts were. Yeah.
Yes. That covers what I had intended to outline. I'd be happy to answer any further questions if the court has any.
Look like it.
Then I will rest on my brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Durham have? 4 minutes.
It's certainly true that ITW assumed the liability for this lawsuit, as Mr. Hong states, but that liability could have taken a variety of forms. And most importantly, it could have taken the form of as low as $800,000 or as high as $1 million if ITW had simply reached out and shook Mr. Lemelson's hand and made a deal. And the fact that it did not take that form is their decision, the result of their decision to reject Mr. Lemelson's offer made in the course of their ordinary business. The government relies very heavily on Webb and Pacific Transport, but I think both of those cases are distinguishable. In both cases, the liability was entirely unavoidable, so that there is no possibility that the taxpayer could have walked away from that liability. The taxpayer was stuck with that liability, and therefore it was a necessary cost of the acquisition. Here, it was not a necessary cost because that liability was avoidable. And in those other cases, there was nothing the taxpayer could have done or not done to avoid that liability. Also in Webb, the government correctly states that the widow in the Webb case could have lived a few years longer or a few years shorter, and therefore the liability was variable. But I don't think she could have outlived her lifespan by a ratio of 17 to 1, which is the fact that we have in this case, where the liability is 17 times, or actually it's more than 17 times, it's 50 or 60 times the party's expectations. And since these cases are a matter of degree and not of kind, I think that that's a relevant distinction.
She could have outlived by a ratio of 17 to 1 if the one was 1 month and the other was 17 months. You're just assuming it was a year. A year to 17 years.
Well,
I'm
saying let's assume that she was, you know, 40 years old at the time of the annuity, and you might assume that she might live to 80, but she's not going to live to 17 times 80.
Well, I understand that.
I think that was...
Of course, as a matter of law, we have a fertile octogenarian theory too that doesn't work. Almost anything can happen as a matter of law.
That's true. The example Mr. Hong used of the mortgage, I think it's obvious why that is not an on-point example, because in a mortgage, the parties both have a complete expectation of what the liability is. And so a pragmatic assessment of those facts tell you that, of course, it makes sense to treat the mortgage as a cost of the acquisition. Mr. Hong also said in these other cases, these expenses were only to facilitate the acquisition. That may be true in Staley, but it's not true in U.S. Freightways. In U.S. Freightways, the expenditure was the asset. The expenditures in question were permits and licenses and such other things, which were the actual asset themselves, not an expense to create the asset. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Durham. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.